Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. What drives Attorney General Merrick Garland? And how is that shaping the Justice Department under his leadership? Well, at his confirmation hearing in February, Garland revealed that his fierce devotion to justice was born of his grandparents' reception in the United States after their escape from anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe.
The country took us in. And protected us. And I feel an obligation to the country to pay back. And this is the highest, best use of my own set of skills to pay back.
Garland's skills are being put to the test. The Justice Department is currently engaged in the largest criminal investigation in U.S. history regarding the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. There is a sharp concern about the rise of domestic terrorism more broadly. There's also sweeping changes to voting laws in many states. Well, earlier this month, Garland described voting as, quote, the central pillar to a healthy democracy. He recalled the words of the late Representative John Lewis.
He said, each of us has a moral obligation to stand up, and speak out. When you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something. Democracy is not a state, it is an act, and each generation must do its part.
Merrick Garland comes to the Attorney General's office with a wealth of experience. He served as a senior Justice Department official during the Clinton administration, led the government's investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing. Temperamentally, he is an institutionalist and was a highly respected chief judge of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., considered the most important appeals court in the nation. And of course, Merrick Garland also endured more than 290 days as a languishing Supreme Court nominee, blocked by the very Republicans who lauded his work on the federal bench. And yet, in his February 2021 confirmation hearing, Garland swore to push partisanship out of the Department of Justice.
I am not the president's lawyer. I am the United States lawyer. And I will do everything in my power, which I believe is considerable, to fend off any effort by anyone to make prosecutions or investigations partisan or political in any way. My job is to protect the Department of Justice.
Protect the DOJ. Well, 3 months into his tenure, it's time to scrutinize if Garland is achieving that goal, especially in a department described by some legal analysts as strewn with political ticking time bombs everywhere. Well, joining me to help with this analysis is Paula Reed. She's senior legal affairs correspondent for CNN, and she joins us from Washington. Paula, it's great to have you back on the show.
I am so thrilled to be back with you today.
So, Paula, first of all, protecting the Department of Justice, how monumental of a task is that, broadly speaking, in 2021?
Gosh, it's hard to think of a bigger task right now. He's entering the halls of the Justice Department at a time of great division. Morale is very low. And while for the most part, the past 7 to 10 years I've been covering the Justice Department, most people really, it just wasn't on their radar. But over the past 5 years, mostly during the Trump administration, the Justice Department, the FBI, it's really come into a lot of people's consciousness and they are paying more attention to it. They have questions about whether they can trust it, whether it has been politicized, and whether Merrick Garland can actually roll back some of the concerns, some of the politicization that we saw under the Trump administration.
So, in fact, I see it as sort of concentric circles of a lack of trust, right? There's the trust that might have broken down within the department itself. There's the trust across Washington and various branches, institutions in Washington. And then, of course, the trust of the American people in the the DOJ. So monumental is a good way to put it. You know, we played those clips a little earlier, just a second ago, to just remind folks how Merrick Garland, Attorney General Garland, talks about his view of what justice is in America. Following that languishing Supreme Court nomination, he went back to the D.C. Circuit and was assiduously apolitical, right? And you heard that again in his confirmation process. Well, two questions. First of all, has he managed to maintain that apolitical stance in the first 3 months of his time as Attorney General?
It appears so. I mean, he's definitely pursuing a strong, robust civil rights agenda. But if you look at what's happening in the country right now, these attacks on voting rights, he really doesn't have much of a choice but to speak up on that. Also, questions of police reform. He has certainly laid out some priorities, both civil rights and domestic terrorism. But again, domestic terrorism, like civil rights, he doesn't have much of a choice. If you look at what's going on in the country, January 6th, you see Charleston, Charlottesville, it's been building for years. He has to, as the nation's top law enforcement official, really take a stance there. But by and large, if you look overall at the past several months, it appears that he has been pretty impartial. That's what President Biden wanted. But that's not what progressive Democrats wanted. And there have been some criticisms of him for being so impartial and for not being more aggressive, particularly with how he's handled some of these holdover issues from the previous administration.
So we'll talk about those issues in a second. And a little later in the show, we'll dive deeper into Garland's plans for the DOJ's expansion of anti-domestic terrorism efforts and what he said about voting in this country. But one more thing about his background, Paula, if we may. I mean, what do you think we need to understand about who he is, his previous work, his time on the D.C. circuit, to really understand what he brings to the Attorney General's office?
So his resume is perfect. It is central casting for a Supreme Court justice. Because there's a big difference, right? He was a federal judge for over 20 years. When you're a judge, you're sort of isolated. You're in your chambers. You're not really sort of in the fray every day, even though you're deciding big cases. But when you're Attorney General of the United States, you are constantly wading into the biggest controversies. I remember reading a profile of Eric Holder at the time, and they just said, look, this job is a magnet. If there is a problem, it's going to stick to you eventually. And that's a big change for him. And I think what we've seen, particularly over the past week or so with the subpoena story coming out, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, I really think we've seen him maybe starting to adjust to the realities that he is no longer a judge. So that's the biggest challenge I see in terms of his resume. He would have been, you know, ideal for a Supreme Court justice writing opinions. But when you're Attorney General, you're going before Congress, you're dealing with the biggest controversies, you're having to answer questions from pesky reporters all the time. It's a big change. And there's an outstanding question about whether he is the right man for this job at this moment.
Well, in fact, as you said a second ago, this is one of the areas of criticism from President Biden's left, from the left flank of the Democratic Party. For example, we spoke with Jeff Hauser, who's founding of the Revolving Door Project, which scrutinizes executive branch appointees. And he said he believes Merrick Garland, despite that picture-perfect CV you talked about, Paula, he says Garland is unprepared to lead the DOJ.
Merrick Garland spent a generation cloistered within the judiciary, developing a myopic view of the world that did not take into account political reality. I don't think Merrick Garland followed the ins and outs of Trump's America. I don't think he knows just how bad it got.
And Hauser also says that in his view, Garland is simply continuing the positions of his predecessor, former Attorney General Bill Barr.
He believes that this continuity in the Department of Justice is a sign of independence. It's a sign that regardless of elections, the Department of Justice remains committed to the rule of law and does not change haphazardly or excessively just because of an election, which would be a reasonable thing to do if you were taking over for Gerald Ford.
Paula Reed would respond to that. What do you think?
I disagree with that analysis. I think that's really cherry picking what has happened over the past several months. It's more complex than that. Yes, the Garland Justice Department has continued to defend the Trump administration's stance in some cases related to the president, which we'll talk about, but he has also undone several of their stances, specifically when it comes to police reform. He's also doubled the staff at the Justice Department dealing with voter suppression, and he is taking domestic terrorism head on. He is willing to directly address the threat of white supremacy in this country. There are many instances where you see Garland not continuing the party line from the Trump administration. To say he's just carrying over all of their positions, it's just not true. But when you want an impartial Justice Department, this is what it looks like. It's a mixed bag, and that's a more fair assessment of what Garland is doing. Yes, he defends some Trump administration policies, but in other instances, he's reversing them.
Okay, so we have about 30 seconds to go before our first break here, but talk more about that for a second. How do you see, this is the political reality that you talked about Garland brushing up against as Attorney General. Do you think thus far he's successfully navigating that, given that he's going to have critics from the left, as we just talked about, and obviously from the right?
Yeah, if you want an independent attorney general, which is what President Biden wanted, this is what it looks like. There are days when you make somebody angry on the left, and there are days when you make somebody angry on the right. This is exactly what it looks like to have an attorney general who's married to the law and not doing the bidding of the White House.
Well, Paula Reed, senior legal affairs correspondent for CNN, stand by for just a second. When we come back, we're going to dive more deeply into some recent revelations coming out of the DOJ, some of those political booby traps I mentioned a second ago. We'll talk about domestic terrorism more and voting as well. We are spending this hour scrutinizing the first 3 months of Merrick Garland's tenure at the Department of Justice. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are scrutinizing the first 3 months of Attorney General Merrick Garland's tenure as the head of the Department of Justice, trying to glean what his actions so far tell us about his view of justice in America, how he's navigating the politics of Washington, D.C., and whether or not he's truly rebuilding trust in the DOJ and maintaining that independence that he promised from the Biden White House. And I'm joined today by Paula Reed. She's senior legal affairs correspondent for CNN, and she's with us from Washington. And Paula, it's time to dive into the latest of some of the recent revelations that have come out of the DOJ. So first of all, there is that story about the fact that couple of members of Congress, Democratic members of Congress, were reportedly the subject of a subpoena by the Trump Justice Department, and that includes House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, whose communications, again, we have been learning, may have been seized by the Trump Justice Department. On MSNBC, Schiff said both Attorney General Merrick Garland and Congress need to address the politicization of the DOJ over the past several years.
I think that the Attorney General has an obligation to clean house, to essentially understand exactly what the department was doing over the last 4 years, make sure that there's accountability for those that were engaged in political and partisan investigations within the department. And, you know, in terms of the oversight by Congress, I don't think I have a role in that, given that some of my records were apparently the subject of a subpoena. But I think other committees, as part of their oversight responsibilities, ought to ask the Attorney General and others. And I do think the department needs to do a wholesale review of the politicization of these cases over the last 4 years.
Now, Paula, first of all, what has your latest reporting revealed about what exactly happened with these subpoenas?
Well, we have a big story, a big whole team, many of my colleagues and I on CNN.com right now. The big question when this was revealed that data had been scooped up from two lawmakers, Adam Schiff, Eric Swalwell, and then also we learned shortly thereafter, White House counsel Don McGahn. Mm-hmm. The big question when the story first broke was whether this was politically motivated. Was the president or someone else at DOJ trying to target people he was unhappy with? Because at the time, he was unhappy with Don McGahn for not firing the special counsel. But we've really dug into this, and we have a lengthy story. The headline is that it appears that most of this data, these requests from Apple, these got scooped up into investigations, during investigations, into other people. So it does not appear, based on our reporting, that any of these people were directly targeted. But the question for Merrick Garland is, when the New York Times, that broke the story originally, came to them with this story, why didn't he get out in front of it? Mm-hmm. And this is where the sort of political machinations, like, right? He may not be aware, because the New York Times broke this story. Instantly, the narrative was that this was political retaliation by the Trump Justice Department. And then after it really became a big story, there was an Office of Inspector General investigation that was announced. And then after that, the Attorney General announced that the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, would look into the policies. How does it work when we get data for lawmakers? But they had an opportunity to get out ahead of this. It looked very reactive. And this is where some of the criticism came at the Attorney General and the Justice Department for not being aggressive enough. But again, as we dig in, we realize this is pretty complicated, but that doesn't absolve the Attorney General of not getting ahead of this, even trying to get ahead of the New York Times, ask the Office of Inspector General for an investigation to review this. Before you read it on the front page of a newspaper, it felt like a political misstep.
Right. So, but what are the potential consequences of, I would say this is an example of Garland's sort of institutionalist temperament, not really comporting with the reality of the light speed at which, as soon as news comes out, what, you know, may be something that actually has a pretty bland explanation becomes instantaneously politicized?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a big question for him is, okay, the Office of Inspector General is going to investigate. That's going to take like 18 months. You have Lisa Monaco reviewing the procedure for lawmakers and what happens when their data is requested or scooped up. What about everyday Americans, sir? Where is your urgency? Is this agency inadvertently scooping up the information of hundreds of, or thousands of Americans and not even realizing what they have? Where is the outrage? Where is the urgency to sort of, you know, right this situation? I think that's the big question for him on this issue. If it really was a mistake, if it wasn't politically motivated, that's not very reassuring that the Justice Department was scooping up information for very powerful people in this country, including the top lawyer for the White House at the time, and either not realizing it or not thinking it was a big deal. He doesn't, I don't think he really sort of grasped the urgency and why this would matter, especially when there's so many concerns about Big Brother and big tech. So it seems he dropped the ball there. And right now, that would be a big question. Where is your urgency for everyday Americans at protecting their data?
Well, I mean, of course, but dialing down the temperature is maybe one of the things that Garland sees as essential to rebuilding the trust in the DOJ.
Absolutely. Because, yeah. I mean, if we look back at Eric Holder, for example, he was very aggressive pursuing the Obama administration's agenda, and he relished going before Congress and fighting. Remember, he and Louie Gohmert one time famously got into a tiff over asparagus, for crying out loud. Was that helpful? right, for the reputation of the Justice Department, especially in the coming year or so when they would enter into an investigation to Hillary Clinton's emails? Was it helpful to raise that sort of partisan rhetoric at that time? It's an open question, and that's really the big question. Is he the right man for the moment? Maybe he is, to bring back impartiality, to bring it back to just sort of like the hardcore legal analysis, which is what we've seen so far, and not as much of the statecraft. It's an open question right now whether this is the right path.
Mm. Well, you heard earlier that criticism from Jeff Hauser that he sees Garland as nothing more than continuing the practices of the Bill Barr DOJ. And I mean, just to spend a little bit more time with that, what we've seen in recent weeks is things including such as Garland opposing or the DOJ opposing the full release of classified department memos regarding Bill Barr himself that he used to distort the findings of the Mueller investigation. That's one thing. DOJ lawyers are continuing to defend former President Donald Trump in a defamation suit filed by E. Jean Carroll, who accuses Donald Trump of rape. And there's also the decision to ask a judge to throw out civil lawsuits against both Trump and Barr. And those lawsuits argue that those men are personally responsible for the violent removal of protesters in Lafayette Square last summer. So how do you read that?
So I really disagree with the analysis that this is just a continuation of the Barr Justice Department. There are instances and cases that he has continued, but it is incorrect to say that carte blanche, he's just carrying over all the policies. And I pointed to those counterexamples with policing and domestic terrorism. But yes, for example, let's take the memo. There is an internal memo that was drafted to sort of explain why they did not pursue charges against President Trump. Now, a judge has looked at this memo and said, give me a break. This isn't legal reasoning. This isn't protected. The attorney general already knew what he was going to do. This is pretextual. Most of this should be released. The Justice Department, though, is trying to protect this. It continues, even though this is about President Trump, even though this was done under Attorney General Bill Barr, they do have precedent to worry about, right? They don't necessarily want a precedent where these kinds of internal deliberations can be made public. And that's really what you have Attorney General Garland thinking about here is precedent. And that's when you get that impartiality, not just thinking about who stands to lose here, but what could happen in the future. That's how a judge thinks. They think about the law and they think about precedent. And people don't like that. They don't like that pursuit. Intelligent minds can disagree. A judge disagreed. But that's what he's thinking about there. It's not necessarily, clearly Bill Barr was right, I'm going to carry his water. It's just thinking about precedent and how this decision could impact the Justice Department in the future.
Okay, so just let me jump in here for a second, because I hear that, Paula. But, you know, we're talking also about Merrick Garland making it a priority to rebuild trust in the Department of Justice. And again, I'm just thinking what Jeff Hauser said about maybe Garland doesn't realize sort of how much the country has changed, especially how much it did under President Trump. I mean, how can you achieve greater trust without at least more transparency, especially regarding actions of the previous Justice Department, which were conceived of as so wildly political under Bill Barr?
I mean, it's a very difficult act to follow, both Attorney General Sessions and Attorney General Barr, because both of them in many ways were seen by the president and maybe saw themselves as an arm of the White House. But I do think intellectually one could argue that maybe this is the perfect time for a judge to be insulated in his chambers, just doing what the law commands. Maybe that is the way to bring trust back and not to sort of watch cable news and be swayed and constantly like looking for, you know, the public opinion one way or the other. Maybe the best way is to just look at the law. Personally, I think the messaging arm, he has a whole public affairs department, they could have been a little more forward leaning. They could be better about explaining some of this to reporters. They could lean in a little bit harder, particularly on the subpoena issue. But I don't think a judge sitting viewing these legal questions just through the eyes of the law and through precedent is the worst way. It's certainly not the worst way to bring trust back to the Justice Department. Again, it's not supposed to be the law firm for the president or for any political party. It's supposed to be the top law enforcement agency in the country and protect people based on the laws that Congress passes.
Okay, so let's shift our focus to for a moment to another hugely important aspect of the Justice Department's current work, and that has to do with combating domestic terrorism. Now, just last week, Garland announced a national strategy, a new national strategy to combat domestic terrorism. And in announcing it, he reflected on the lessons he learned during his investigation into the Oklahoma City bombing.
We have now, as we have then, an enormous task ahead to move forward as a country, to punish the perpetrators, to do everything possible to prevent similar attacks, and to do so in a manner that affirms the values on which our justice system is founded and upon which our democracy depends. The resolve and dedication with which the Justice Department has approached the investigation of the January 6th attack reflects the seriousness with which we take this assault on a mainstay of our democratic system, the peaceful transfer of power.
Well, joining us now is Frank Figluzzi. He's a former FBI assistant director. He's currently NBC News national security contributor and also host of the podcast The Bureau with Frank Figluzzi. Frank, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so you heard Attorney General Garland directly tie the new national strategy to combat domestic terrorism to the January 6th attack. What's your first take on what Garland is proposing?
I've read through it several times. The document runs about 30 pages, and my initial reaction is that it's largely devoid of the kind of details that I think America needs to hear and see, because without those details, it's far less of a blueprint and just kind of more of a sketch of where this strategy might be going. I'll give you some examples, and they tie into the discussion you just had with Paula about this whole dilemma of being a conservator attorney general and whether or not, you know, being a conservator might actually require you to be far more assertive kind of activist in order to bring to the ship. Right the ship. So, for example, in the strategy, we see language aimed at using, quote, non-governmental entities for things like threat assessments and remaining aware of what's going on out there. Well, we don't know what that means. Is this an attempt to essentially outsource threat analysis? Does that mean that the rules within the DOJ and FBI have not been changed, and therefore we're going to let the private sector, maybe even big tech, which has a very robust analysis component to it, are we going to let them do it? And does that circumvent all the rules and regulations of why the FBI can't spy on American citizens? We simply don't know. And then when it comes to the big question in the strategy of, hey, should we have a law against domestic terrorism, there's an entire section that in very contorted language says we're kind of fixing to get ready to think about maybe we might need a new law. So I think, you know, the devil's in the details, and the details are missing here.
Right. Well, I mean, regarding whether or not we need a new law to combat domestic or to define domestic terrorism, there is a great deal of debate over that. You were on the show when we talked about it beforehand. There's a lot of people, there are a lot, many people who think that extant law may actually be enough. But Garland also talked about, you know, hiring more agents, expanding, to put it very broadly, the reach of the DOJ. Can you talk a little bit about that, Frank?
Sure. When we have a crisis in our government like this, we see a threat. Now it's internal, or we've seen it external at 9/11. We tend to throw bodies at it, and even things like deadbeat dad laws, carjacking. We went through a period of carjacking in major cities becoming a problem. What did we do? We pointed to the FBI and other agencies, and we said, more bodies, more analysts, more money, and let's try to tackle this. And that's something that we do. But I'm here to tell you, based on my experience 25 years as an FBI agent and talking with onboard FBI agents, That's all well and good, and they'll take it. But until the rules of the road change, until they're allowed to do more and more tools are put in their toolkit to combat domestic terrorism, namely to kind of take off the reins in terms of assessing through perhaps sophisticated algorithms, millions of social media messages that speak toward violence, until that's more permitted, I'm concerned that January 6th could repeat itself. And so while we're putting all the steps in place for a very whole of society approach articulated in this national strategy, nothing's changed with regard to the FBI's governing policies.
Well, as I read it, it's a four-pronged plan that includes, what, $100 million in the 2022 proposed budget for adding that personnel we talked about, bolstering the ranks of prosecutors, analysts, and investigators. Paula Reed, we've just got about 30 seconds before the next break. What do you think of Frank's concerns about what's missing from Garland's sort of whole of country proposal here?
Well, it's spot on. There's a lot of money being thrown, a lot of words being thrown around, but there are not a lot of details. And this has been a perpetual challenge for the Justice Department. How do you confront domestic terrorism when you also have to be careful not to infringe on anyone's First Amendment right, which is why you heard Garland there say they are going to be focused on violence, not ideology, but in practice, that's going to be a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah, so I actually want to hear from both of you a little bit more about that when we come back from a quick break. We are scrutinizing the first 3 months of Attorney General Merrick Garland's tenure at the Department of Justice. Much more when we come back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cuneo was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at Attorney General Merrick Garland's first 3 months as the head of the Department of Justice and what his actions as Attorney General tell us about his view of justice overall in America and whether or not he is making progress on his promise to depoliticize the DOJ and to build trust in the department once again. I'm joined today by Paula Reed. She's senior legal affairs correspondent for CNN. She's with us from Washington. Frank Figluzzi is also with us as well, former FBI assistant director. He's NBC News national security contributor and host of the podcast, The Bureau with Frank Figluzzi, and he joins us from Tucson, Arizona. And Frank, I just wanted to quickly pick up on what Paula mentioned right there before the end of the previous segment about Attorney General Garland very assiduously staying away from saying that the DOJ would investigate ideology, right? I mean, because when he announced the national strategy to push back on domestic terrorism, he basically said explicitly, quote, "We do not prosecute people for their beliefs that across the world, extremist or terrorist labels have at times been affixed to those perceived as political threats to the ruling order. But there's no place for partisanship in the enforcement of the law. The Justice Department will not tolerate any such abuse of authority." But what does it tell you that he is saying that he's going to stay, you know, very, very far away from using the power of the Justice Department to do anything to uproot the ideology which led to the attack on Congress on January 6th?
Well, first, let me state clearly, he's absolutely right on the money. We must preserve civil liberties and privacy and free speech if we're going to preserve our country and democracy, as we know that. Mm-hmm. But I think where this kind of falls down is the notion that somehow securing our nation and preserving civil liberties are mutually exclusive. They can't be done together. And they absolutely can be done together. And his repeated statements on this, and even the 30-some-odd page national strategy for countering domestic terrorism, goes out of its way, almost contorts itself in its language to say, yep, oh, no, we're not looking at ideas. and rhetoric. We're only going to look at violence. And then this new phrase that's been introduced, by the way, called imminent violence. So now, you know, if anybody were to say, Frank, have you seen any different change in stance on how this might be investigated? The change I see is now we're saying we're putting an adjective in front of violence and calling it imminent violence. So in the old days, you know, prior strategy, you had to almost wait for the violence to happen and then come in and clean up afterwards. And now we're seeing imminent violence. So that is encouraging. But again, we're nowhere near, as a government, what even Facebook can do on a daily basis. They have sophisticated algorithms that tell them, even anonymously, this user is talking about hurting somebody repeatedly. And at the point where that becomes a concern, they can then send that tip over to the FBI. They do it every single day. And it can be done anonymously. And then the FBI can come back and say, please tell us the identity of that user. Until I see an approach like that being offered, I'm not convinced that the rules have changed enough to get us to a place where we can prevent the next act of domestic terrorism.
Well, I have to say, I really appreciate you pointing out the addition of that one adjective about imminent violence, because I guarantee you that is going to be, that civil libertarians are going to be focusing on that with a laser-like intensity as time goes on. But listen, Frank and Paula, we also have to, before we get too much further towards the end of the show, have to talk about voting as well as another major area of the DOJ's focus, of Garland's focus in particular. Because, first of all, let's just listen to what he said earlier this month when Garland unveiled his plan, or the DOJ's plan, to protect voting rights.
There are many things that are open to debate in America, but the right of all eligible citizens to vote is not one of them. The right to vote is the cornerstone of our democracy, the right from which all other rights ultimately flow.
Now, a key part of the Garland plan is to double the DOJ's Civil Rights Division staff. And that division enforces voting rights protections. But Adrian Jones is a professor of politics, race, and law at Morehouse College in Atlanta. And she says that the division no longer has one of its strongest mechanisms for protecting the right to vote. That is preclearance.
If your state had used a test or device to restrict the vote or to restrict registration, and less than half of the Black voting age population in your jurisdiction or state had voted in particular presidential elections, your state or jurisdiction would need to submit any new voting law for review from the federal government.
Now, preclearance protections were eliminated in that 2013 Supreme Court decision of Shelby v. Holder. But Professor Jones says the Justice Department still has important oversight powers as part of the Voting Rights Act.
I do want Merrick Garland to use those additional people to oversee elections with election observers, which is provided for both in H.R. 4 and in the Voting Rights Act. I'd also like him to enforce Section 11 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits voting fraud, right? Voting twice and making sure that people are not falsely registering to vote.
And Professor Jones says she wants Garland to be aggressive in addressing nationwide efforts to change state-level voting laws.
People are in danger as a result of these elections. Georgia elected officials, Georgia candidates, Georgia voting activists were subject to threats and violence in 2018 and 2020. Nationwide, we've had people threatened in 2020. There are concerns about what happened in the Maricopa County recount, not only in terms of threatening people and making them uncomfortable, but the fact that you've now reviewed their information and been able to have an opportunity to identify who they are. You know, these are the kinds of things that went on during Jim Crow.
Adrian Jones, she's a professor of politics, race, and law at Morehouse College and currently working on a book about the Voting Rights Act. Well, Paula Reed, first of all, talk to me about how Merrick Garland has talked about what he sees the DOJ's role is in protecting voting rights in 2021.
This has been one of the areas in which he is sort of willing to wade into the larger political debate. He's been clear that where they see violations of people's constitutional rights here, they will not hesitate to act. He's also taken a pretty dim view of the so-called audits underway in Arizona. And we have to remember, on this particular issue, it's not just the attorney general. It's also the number three at the Justice Department, Vinita Gupta, who will likely have a big role in this. And if you look at her record, she has been nothing, if not aggressive, in defending civil rights during her time in the Obama Justice Department and her work outside government during the Trump administration. So it does appear that on this particular issue, he is willing somewhat to wade into the political conversation. And not only has he teed this up in a way that he could make this one of his signature issues, but he also has a deputy who is likely expected to be very aggressive on this.
Do you think that that Garland and the DOJ have adequate tools at their disposal, even after the Shelby v. Holder ruling?
Well, certainly not to the extent that they did prior and under the Trump administration. I mean, that part, the Civil Rights Department of the Justice Department, was really gutted. It's been largely dormant. So, no, their ability to really police this is not what it was before. But it does appear that they have no choice to address the issue. Right. Mm-hmm. Looking at what's going on across the country, this is clearly a priority for a lot of Republicans. It doesn't look like this is going to get resolved in Congress. So he has to do something. And it does appear that of all of the issues, this is one where he is willing to lean in a little bit more.
OK, well, Frank, you know, regarding domestic terrorism, you said that that government has the habit of throwing more people at a problem. It sounds like, you know, even though the Civil Rights Division had been gutted, throwing more people at the problem is part of Garland's approach here on voting rights, doubling the Civil Rights Division staff. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think I applaud that effort if it results in more action, because, you know, bodies need to translate to action, and time's a wasting, as they say, with regard to these so-called fraudits that are occurring. Because, look, Garland's between a rock and a hard place here. I get the fact that if he were to sweep in and, say, have the U.S. Marshals raid this cabin in Montana where allegedly the Maricopa, Arizona votes have been sequestered, and it would be a very dramatic scene, immediately there would be those on the right who say, look at this, he's stopping a valid audit. Clearly he's become highly political and will never get to the truth. And I think I think he almost is taking a strategy of, look, we sent a letter. We told them, be really careful. You're on thin ice when it comes to securing your ballots. We're taking a look at it. But he almost now might be waiting for how this comes out to then challenge it so that he can say, well, I let it happen. You got your fraud it. But here's the dilemma with that. And here's the tie to domestic terrorism. You get what you pay for in these so-called fraudits. And so it's been paid for by people who want fraud to be found, whether it exists or not. And there's no evidence that it does exist. So when they come out and announce, holy cow, you know, it looks like Trump actually won Arizona, all based on nonsense cyber ninja findings, now you're left with a public perception among those on the right who will be inspired to take action, even violent action, based on those findings. So Garland's sitting there going, do I move now and get accused of being political and stopping an audit? Or do I wait for very dangerous false findings to be announced that could inspire violence? This is why Garland seems to have the toughest cabinet position in the Biden administration.
Well, Paula Reed, we keep bumping up against this question about how to navigate politicization of the actions of the Justice Department. But it must be stated clearly that the broader picture of voting rights rules being changed in various states in this country have all happened through perfectly legal processes, right? I mean, legislatures have passed laws that were signed by governors. And so, you know, the fraudits aside, if Garland and the DOJ get involved in any capacity regarding those state-level laws, how can it not be perceived as anything but political?
Exactly. I mean, it would depend on the specific instance, something that is validly passed by a state legislature. He's not necessarily going to get involved in that. That is something that could potentially, though, be the center of a lawsuit that slowly makes its way to the Supreme Court. You'd have to look at it case by case. He certainly has a role to play. The Civil Rights Division has a role to play. This issue, right, it's just getting more and more broad. This is clearly a priority. It's not just happening in one state or two states. It's happening across the country in different formats. And he absolutely has a role to play through his civil rights division. And it does appear that, he is willing to engage on this, just as he also is willing to engage on domestic terrorism and on police reform, which are three of easy examples of how he is, in fact, different than his predecessors.
Okay, so we've got about 4 minutes left here. And the last piece of this puzzle that I want to get to is one, Paula, that I know you have a ton of reporting on. But it's a way to look at how Garland's next steps might shed light on how he's running the Justice Department. And that is Congressman Matt Gaetz is under investigation. How is this a test coming up for Attorney General Garland?
So anytime the Justice Department even considers charging a sitting congressman or woman, that is an enormous undertaking. You have to make sure that the investigation, that the charges are devoid of any sort of political ambitions, but any sort of political motivation. Here, we know a lot about the investigation into Congressman Gaetz, not only from our reporting, but also the fact that his longtime friend and colleague, Joel Greenberg, who was charged with 33 federal counts, he's entered into a plea deal. And from that plea deal, we've learned a lot about the overall investigation. We know the congressman is under investigation not only for questions about having sex with a minor, possible sex trafficking, public corruption, and potentially obstruction of justice. Now, we know from our sources this investigation is still active. They're still bringing witnesses before the grand jury, because you really got to make sure you're crossing your T's and dotting your I's if you're going to bring potential charges against a congressman to Maine Justice. This is not something that's just going to happen in Florida. This is something that's going to have to go to Maine Justice, where the Public Integrity Unit has been working on this case. But if they charge Congressman Gaetz, I mean, this could really be a political football for the attorney general, because he's not just any Republican congressman. I mean, this is someone who embodies MAGA. I mean, he has gone all in support of the former president, who I will note has been pretty much silent on this case and has not defended him. But this is a big test, because depending on the nature of the charges, if this is more of a political corruption obstruction case, historically, political corruption cases have been a little tricky for the Justice Department, obstruction less so. Then there's questions about sex trafficking, sex with a minor, prostitution. How will that play with a Florida grand jury? It would be a disaster for the Garland-Biden Justice Department to charge a congressman like Matt Gaetz and have that not be a successful prosecution. So that's really going to be something he's going to have to look very carefully at all the evidence that has been gathered and assess whether it is supported by the facts and whether he should pursue that case and if it'll be successful. Because, again, it's someone who just wants to always look at the law, but there are huge political ramifications for charging a congressman, particularly one of the opposite party, particularly one who has so closely aligned himself with former President Trump.
Yeah. Well, Frank, do you want to give us your take on that?
Paul has really gotten this right with regard to the fact that this has to be tied up with a bow and a ribbon, as prosecutors like to say, before they're going to go on this one. It's not black and white. I see so many people on social media saying, hey, come on, this is sex with a minor. It's really easy. It's not. The charges that we're talking about here involving trafficking and crossing state lines, if you dig down into the details, a third party app is involved here, where it allows the person to have plausible deniability and say, well, I was paying for gifts or hotel rooms, travel, but not for the sex. And then the corruption angle here, that essentially all of these things were given to Gaetz in return for an expectation of political favors. Very complicated and difficult to prove these days. They've got to get this one right, or they're going to look very political.
Well, Frank Figliuzzi is a former FBI assistant director, now NBC News national security contributor and host of The Bureau with Frank Figliuzzi. It's always great to have you, Frank. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Paula Reed, senior legal affairs correspondent for CNN. Paula, thank you as always for your expertise in reporting.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.